Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about some kind of miscellaneous cryptographic tools. We started with cryptographic hashes. So these were hash functions, but we weren't like actually using these to like make a hash table. We were using these primarily as kind of a secure way of summarizing something, where we wanted it to be the case that, you know, if we had a particular hash function output, you couldn't easily find something else with that hash function output. You couldn't choose a hash function output and find something that hashes to it. And sort of one application of this was that this was a suitable summary for signatures, because it turns out many digital signature schemes don't actually kind of let us sign something that's infinitely long. They require us to sign something that's small. This is a way of getting something that's small that summarizes anything in a way where an attacker can't make that summary be misinterpreted as something else, because they can't find something else that produces the same hash value. Then we talked about asymmetric key agreement. We mentioned that, well, there's this kind of specialized sort of math used for having two parties agree on a key that, shares some attributes with these public-private key systems, but doesn't actually use public key encryption or itself. And we were mentioning it primarily because it's sort of actually used in things like TLS. And kind of our central idea is we produce these key shares, which are kind of like public keys. And we can combine our key share with someone else's key share with our private data that produced a key share to basically get our key with that party. And then we talked about sort of combining these all together to produce what TLS, the sort of way we do encryption for websites, how that works. So we had these certificates we talked about before combined with this key agreement, where the certificates with a digital signature let us verify that the key shares came from the right place. We used the key agreement to agree on these symmetric keys, and we used the symmetric cryptography, shared key encryption and message authentication codes to actually run the entire connection, because that's just faster. And we also talked a bit about, some other practical challenge was generating random numbers, that often we want to generate private keys, we want to generate these keys in general, and they're supposed to be kind of random. How do we do that? And kind of the practical solution is kind of we try to sample information from our environment that an attacker can't know. Like the most straightforward way is we make some hardware that is sort of physically unpredictable and use get bits from that. We can't do that. We like look at when exactly do things happen, assuming that that's not guessable. So questions about cryptography topics before we pipeline. Okay, and we also covered pipelining, which we'll get into a bit more later. Given the quiz, I will first talk about things. So some anonymous feedback. Since we had very busy office hours at certain times on Thursday, people noticed the office hour queue is sorted by the last time people were helped on the office hour queue. My hope is that concerns about this aren't a concern, because we have enough TA help that you get help fast enough that it doesn't matter how the queue is sorted. I will mention, however, that the queue actually supports giving a number to the top few people in the queue and doing that in first come, first serve, which I did not inform the TAs about what the switches that turn that on and off do. The intention being that would be turned off overnight, so people don't like join the queue at 11 p.m. for office hours at 9 a.m. the next day. Yes?
Yeah, sometimes, I know for page tables, like, I sat in office hours for 1:15 and the TAs got
2 TAs.
So,
yes, my hope is the primary way we deal with this is that TAs get through people quickly enough, and in particular, that we make let people make progress, help someone else and get back to them. I know that doesn't always happen. I try to encourage my TAs that's how they should be running office hours, is that like you don't sit with someone for 30 minutes if there's someone else waiting. You like get them to do something on their own and help that other person and then go back. But I know that doesn't always happen. TAs really feel bad about going away from students, which they shouldn't, but I understand why. It's hard. Also, some feedback saying they really like the washing machine analogy. That comes from Patterson and Hennessy's textbook, which I first learned about when I TA'd computer architecture at Berkeley back in 2010, with the first author. And a comment that the quiz this week seemed, with the questions on sort of cryptography, seemed a lot more nebulous. I think the scores bear part of that out. So I guess there's two things on this, so probably I should try to come up with some more things to do in lecture and figure out what topics to cut to fit more examples in lecture. I'll try to go over the quiz sort of question, which will hopefully make that clear. Also, the lab, which is tomorrow, is supposed to help with this. And I always feel mixed things about, do I want to only cover the thing on the quiz after we do the lab on it or not? Because that there are problems with both ideas. And this semester I've sort of decided if it's in lecture, I'll cover it on the quiz immediately. Maybe that's the wrong choice. But obviously there's problems with delaying it and that you have a quiz on something you've forgotten, which isn't great. So, looking at the first quiz question, kind of how I look at it is I look at this protocol and I say, let's look at each piece of information and try to categorize it by how they're protected by one of our cryptographic tools. And this is kind of how I primarily try to answer the question. So I say, okay, when going from student to the registrar, the name and the size of that list, that's not protected in any way. There's nothing that ensures the attacker can't know that. We can just read that off the wire without knowing anything. We don't need any keys or anything like that. And also, the attacker can kind of adjust that by just changing the message. There's nothing that prevents the attacker from producing a message with a different name or a different number of items in the list, like by removing cubes. There's some stuff which is hashed and signed. So the hashing means that the attacker can't like directly tell what it is, but they can verify guesses, right? Because the attacker knows the hash function, they can apply that function to as many things as they have time to do. And it's signed, so the attacker can't just replace it without that signature becoming invalid. And that's the sort of course identities being registered for. So that made some of the things the attacker might want to do a little harder. And the course section requested was encrypted with a public key. So the attacker can't decrypt that, so they can't figure out what that actually is, because only the registrar has the private key to decrypt that. But the attacker can replace it with their own message to the registrar, because anyone can make a public key encrypted message to using a public key. And similarly, going from the registrar to the student, we can say, okay, there's some stuff which is signed, so the attacker cannot replace it with something else without it being noticed. That was the name and time. And there's some stuff which is encrypted, which means the attacker can replace, but they can't sort of read it out of the message. And that's the list of courses registered for. Yeah?
So this question 1B was about getting a list of sections, if I recall correctly. How would this prevent, because the sections weren't encrypted, why would the attacker not be able to read the sections?
Why would the attacker not be able to read the sections? So the sections were not sent in this direction. They were sent in the other direction, from student to registrar.
Oh, I see. It's okay. So specifically about the question.
Yeah. Yes.
Section ID might look like, could they try a bunch of sections encode them with the public key and then see if they match.
The question is, if the attacker knows a bunch of sections, can they just try encrypting things with the public key until it matches? Yeah, so the answer is no, and I guess I should have gone over more clearly that this is a thing we need for public key encryption, right, is that you can't do that. And you might say, how does that work with public key encryption? So usually if you look at a specific algorithm for public key encryption, part of it is to prevent that sort of guessing reversibility, is that they'll randomize the encrypted message. So before applying sort of the mathematical function, part of the input will be some random data to make it so you can't just check guesses. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Going back to B, was the reason that you can't determine, so looking at, if you're observing what students are sending to the registrar, right, because you can still read the message, but now, and like just recording it, is the reason why this is not viable because that portion is encrypted, and so you have to decrypt it before reading it?
So the question is, the reason I can't get these specific sections is because it's encrypted? Yeah, so I can't even check guesses because the encryption, you know, should prevent that, should be randomized to prevent that. But I can check guesses for the courses, which is why we said a small list of courses, I can just get the hash of each thing on that list and compare the hashes, but that doesn't work for encryption because it's not, it doesn't give us the same encrypted message every time. Is it encrypted using the public key? That's always asymmetric, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we would not say public key if it's symmetric.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. And I have, and question two asked a bit about certificate authorities and the role of having a chain of certificate authorities. For A, I meant the question to be read as, will multiple certificate authorities verify these specific websites? But you can also read it as, if you trust multiple certificate authorities, will that let you trust that website? So I dropped it. What I wanted to get across is that like only the last certificate in the chain verifies the actual website, so only one certificate authority has told you it's correct. It's just another certificate authority might have told you, trust this other certificate authority, the second certificate authority for me, earlier in the chain. If you actually wanted a system where you like made sure three certificate authorities verified a website, these chains don't do it. I think that was, and I think most people got the rest of that question. So, question three, which was where there was, I think, the second most confusion. So, in question three, we had this protocol where A chose a key, sent it to B, B sent it back, and we were asking sort of what that achieved and did not achieve. And the first question asks, can A know that they actually sent anything to B? And the answer is yes, because A chose the key, A chose the contents of the message, and no one else knows that. And they get something back, which had to be produced by decrypting that message. So they know at some point in this process, B decrypted that message. So they got a message to B, maybe some other stuff is going on, but B is involved somehow. They're sure of that. And a problem that, like, my limitations on that, you know, B is involved, is that this protocol kind of lets you trick B into decrypting anything for you, because that's what you have B has to do to produce their message back. And for D and E, that was just looking at, realized that the way this works is A chose K, A had to send it first, everything else needs to be consistent with that, or else we're not doing that protocol anymore. questions? Yes. So the question is, for the scenario in C, don't we need the private key that B, so the private key corresponding to where how B is sending back the message? Yes. The question was asking, can an attacker doing this protocol with B instead of A? So the attacker in this case, would you take the place of A? Presumably B is communicating with A and M, right? And the idea is that M could take advantage of B's willingness to communicate with it to have B send back a message like it would to A, but encrypted to M's public key, and therefore M would be able to decrypt it. Or to put another way, we can imagine like A could use this to let have B decrypt anything for it. If A acquires a message encrypted to B. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Why is, like, it says B cannot verify that it ever received a message from A? Is that because, like, it could have been from an attacker and not A? Or?
Question, why cannot B cannot verify it ever received a message from A? Because an attacker takes the place of A, there's nothing that proves anyone had A's private keys or anything else only A knows that B was received.
But B would think it was A only because of the public key? Or, like, if there was no attacker, how does it even know it's A?
Presumably, like, if we think of networking, right, the source on the packets that came in is A, right? That could be A, but that could just be sent by the attacker. And because even though B sent something back encrypted to A, the attacker never needs to decrypt that to do the rest of the protocol. Yeah. So the question is, didn't the attacker choose the K? The attacker can do this with any message that's encrypted to B's public key. So what the attacker does is the attacker says, I'm not going to follow all the rules of this protocol, but I know what B is going to. So I'm going to take this message that I don't actually know what the K is in it and send it to B as if I chose it as the K. That makes sense? K is encrypted, but M can decrypt it, right? Because M knows
like,
the key.
Then K would have like two layers of encryption. One is like the original layer of encryption.
Question, would K have two layers of encryption? If I was writing that, I would write that it was, so I wrote like that it's P of B's key K, right? If I wanted to indicate two layers of encryption, I'd do something like this. Right. Does that make sense? Like, there's only one layer of encryption in the message that's sent back. Because I need to indicate that the encryption two encryption functions were applied to say there were actually two layers. The attacker in this scenario, yes, would know P, E, B is public key, K, and wouldn't know what K is, and they could use the protocol to find out what K is. And because we don't actually need K to be a key, they can use this to find out potentially useful messages. Okay, other questions? right, so let's get back to pipelining. So go through the other quiz questions on pipelining. So pipelining, you mentioned, had this sort of, we do the first step of one instruction, then we do the second step of that instruction while doing the first step of the next instruction, and so on. So if we make our table for the scenario in question four, we had a four-stage pipeline, so the instructions go through four steps. And we were asking, we had instruction A, then B, then C. When would instruction C do its last step? And that's cycle five using the number we had there. And similarly, on question five, we had 1,000 instructions. And we're going to start one every cycle, so that would be 1,000 cycles to start all of them. And then 7 cycles for the last one to finish. The other ones will finish before the last one because they're all kind of one cycle behind, or one cycle ahead of them, because they started earlier. And that's easily less than, with a cycle time of 1 nanosecond, that's easily less than 1,500 nanoseconds. So questions about the pipelining questions on the quiz? Okay. So we did these exercises last time, let's do different exercise. So let's say I take my processor with 5 pipeline stages and I split each of the stages in half and I decrease my cycle time from 500 picoseconds to 250 picoseconds. What's my throughput? So I've just done, so here, if you remember, we had from last time we had this one instruction every 500 picoseconds. And now we're doing this modification. So what's the new group? Who thinks A, B, C, D, E, no clue? Okay, a few no clues, so I guess I need to review this from last time. So with our scenario last time, our starting scenario here, I have a 5-stage pipeline. That's going to be the sort of the standard one we deal with. And my latency is the time from beginning to end. And if my cycle time is 500 picoseconds, that beginning to end is 5 cycles. So that gave me 2,500 picoseconds. So that's the beginning to end time of each instruction. But the instructions overlap. So it turns out that every 500 picoseconds, we finish a new instruction. So we sort of continue this picture here. And look at the time between when instructions finish. That's going to be this one cycle, 500 picoseconds. Every 500 picoseconds, a new instruction is going to finish. So sort of in the long run, we're finished doing one instruction every 500 picoseconds. And so that gives us our throughput. Our throughput's the rate of doing many instructions. Questions? How I got that latency and that throughput. Yeah?
So like the number of steps doesn't affect the throughput?
So the number of steps doesn't affect the throughput? Yes. So assuming we start one instruction every cycle, the first step, yep. So we'll see some ways where practically, there'll be some practicalities that make the number of steps start mattering. But for this sort of level of depth, it doesn't matter. Other questions? Yeah. Oh, seems to be audio quality. Let's try making the mic a little less hot. See if that helps. Okay. So the plurality got the answer that we have one instruction and we double the number of stages and manage to get half the cycle time, we'll have double the throughput. And that's because if we think of continuing this diagram, now every one cycle, which is now 250 picoseconds, we're starting a new instruction. In the long run, that's how fast we'll run instructions. So it seems from this, you know, that if this is where how things worked, we should just have an infinite number of stages and our processors will run infinitely fast. Obviously, that's not actually possible. So there's some kind of physical limits that are going to keep us from actually doing this. So doubling the number of stages and having the cycle time. And we'll talk about that. Yes. What is throughput?
Yeah.
So latency is the beginning to end time. But when we're running a program, we want to like run a million instructions. So we'll talk about throughput, which is the time to run all those million instructions. And generally when we talk about throughput, we're going to talk about it as if we had an infinite number of instructions. So it's just the rate at which we can do instructions. So we have these stages, so we can't actually have it. So what's going to happen is that we're going to run into some physical limitations, and kind of the biggest one, or I guess the most fundamental one, probably not actually the biggest one, is that when we did this pipelining, we had to store values between the stages, and we added registers to do that. And I've been kind of acting as if, in, at least in terms of saying we go from 500 to 50, that those extra registers are free. But of course, they're physical things that are not infinitely fast. So they aren't free. They have some what we'll call register delay, some amount of time they need to actually work. And we need to set our cycle time to include that time, or else they won't operate correctly. So let's say, for example, my registers take 10 picoseconds to do their work of storing the values for the next stage to use. Then if I have, say, 100 picoseconds of the logic for my instruction, and I split that exactly in half, I'm going to go from 110 picoseconds per cycle, because during every cycle I need to do all that logic and have the register do it work, to 60 picoseconds per cycle, because I need to do half that work, plus I need the register to do the same amount of work, it's just storing values, that still takes roughly the same amount of time. And this means that as we make our number of stages higher and higher, you know, that register delay is going to be a bigger and bigger portion of our cycle time, and we're not going to be able to productively increase the number of stages and get that sort of doubling by, you double the number of stages to double the performance. That's not going to happen. We're in fact going to do a lot worse than that. So we can kind of think, you know, we get this sort of, here I'm plotting our cycle time basically for the number of stages, assuming we have some register delay, and we know the register delay kind of gives us kind of an asymptotic bound of like, how good we can do if we keep adding more and more stages. We're just going to get closer to that register delay. We aren't going to get infinitely fast. And we're also going to have kind of, as we add more stages, the sort of impact of that is going to be less and less as that register delay becomes more significant. And this is actually a pretty optimistic picture. Because I'm assuming here that I'm going to split up my logic in half. And if we think about what my processor was doing here, you know, I'm saying we do an instruction cache access here. We're doing a register read here. I'm doing an add here. And you might vaguely remember ways of building adders from CS01. Can you split that in half easily? Well, kind of, through those ways, it's not great. Can we split the instruction cache in half? Maybe not. So usually it's going to be the case that we won't manage to quite split the logic exactly in half. That we can divide it up into pieces, but they won't be exactly half. They'll be somewhat uneven, just because the reality is that you can't like stop and add halfway through, store the values you have for later, and then resume that add, which is what we're asking to have happen here. you're going to have to do it something other than halfway through. So we'll get some waste because one of the things we split it up into are bigger than the others. Often there's some will be a little bit bigger because you know, there will be things that previously overlap that no longer overlap. So we'll end up with worse than that ideal return because you know, we just can't figure out a way of dividing it up evenly. So this means that although we'd like to keep adding more and more pipeline stages, you know, practically speaking, there's going to be a relatively modest limit beyond which it's probably not worthwhile. So questions? These diminishing returns.
Is there a current number of stages that seems to be a good amount?
So what you'll see in practice depends on sort of type of processor and things like that. For kind of current desktop, laptop-oriented processors, I think like 10 to 15 is probably common. Though the stages, as we'll talk about later when we talk about out-of-order processors, work very differently than what we're talking about here. There are some more specialized processors will sometimes have higher number of stages. So like one way GPUs often work is by having sort of relatively deep pipelines. And also historically there's been processors with like very few or very many pipeline stages. So. Most notably, when manufacturers want to give you a high clock frequency number, a way to do that is to make the pipeline stages really small. And that this like happened in the Pentium 4 era, famously. Okay, so we've talked about sort of this trade-off that as we increase pipeline stages, we can't make the clock speed increase correspondingly to actually give us sort of the corresponding increase in performance. We'll get something better, but it won't be like twice as good for twice as many stages. So there's another practical issue with pipelining that we need to deal with, which is not a performance one, but a correctness one. And that's going to be a class of issues we'll call hazards. I have an example here where I have two adds. So I'm adding from R8 to R9, and then from R9 to R8. And the second add is supposed to take the result of the first add and add it again to something else and store that. If we look at how this gets executed in our pipeline processor, where I've split up into the stages we talked about last time, first, we're going to have our first add instruction read from the instruction cache. So in our fetch stage, we're going to read from address. In this example, we're assuming it's at the machine code's at address 0. And we're going to get stuff to put in this set of pipeline registers to say, what registers do we want to read? So we're going to get 8 and 9. Those are the registers we want to read. So in the next cycle, we're going to be reading from registers 8 and 9 while we're fetching the second add instruction. All as we expect. We're doing the first step of the second instruction, we're doing the second step of the first instruction. So then we're going to read our values of 8 and 9 for the first instruction, and we're going to say that 800 and 900, we'll assume those are initial values for R8 and R9, keep things simple. And we're also going to pass through that, oh, we're going to want to write to register 9 later. And meanwhile, we'll have figured out that the next instruction wants to read from R9 and R8. So during the next cycle, we're going to have the instruction, the first add here, doing its math. It's going to add 800 and 900 together. And at the same time, our second instruction is going to read R9 and R8. Which, because we haven't like completed getting the first instruction all the way through our pipeline, are currently 900 and 800. even though we're supposed to change it from the first instruction. So we have this problem here that we're reading the value 900 for the second instruction, which is the old value of R9, ignoring that the first instruction is supposed to change it to 900 plus 800 equals 1700. We have the wrong number. So by adding pipelining, I have made my processor incorrect. And obviously, that's not going to be something we need to fix. And this problem in general, the idea that I'm going to add pipelining by dividing up into these stages, putting registers in between them, and then when I do that, suddenly my instructions can't execute correctly. This problem in general is known as a hazard. And hazards that result from us reading the wrong values of registers we'll call data hazards. Yes? So your question is, could we fix this by generating assembly code that realizes, oh, that first add needs to happen before the second one? Absolutely. We'll talk about that very explicitly. So we have this data hazard. And another view of the data hazard is, if we look at what our pipeline implementation does to execute these instructions, because we're overlapping instructions, the order we end up doing is we read the values for the first instruction, we read the values for the second instruction, then we store the values for the first instruction, and we store the values for the second instruction. But that's not what our specification for what the processor should do for the assembly language says. The specification says the first instruction modifies R9, the second one reads the value that was just modified. So we have a disagreement here between sort of how we said assembly works and what we actually implement, because we're doing things in a different order. And one solution for dealing with this is to say, well, our problem here is that whoever specified how the add instruction works was wrong. That it was silly to say when you add into R9 that R9 changes immediately. That's because that's that hard to implement. So why don't we specify it differently? Why don't we say all the add instructions take effect 3 instructions later, and just when you're writing assembly, you just need to keep this in mind. You need to keep in mind when you write an add instruction, you can't use the value you just added right away. You need to wait 3 instructions before you can do that. And this would make it the compiler's job to deal with this problem. And this is a solution that real processors have used. It is not one which is popular. And the primary reason it's not popular is because if we think of upgrading processors, we want to change the specification as we change the processor pipeline, which means that for this to work well, we basically want to recompile every time we upgrade our processor. And there's been many people in academia who thought that that was a fine idea that we should do. People in industry have not agreed on that in practice. People in industry really like giving you a pre-compiled program and just using it forever. Yeah, and I note that my assumption here that I can only add 2 no-ops is kind of assuming that we can read a value while it's being written. If we can't do that, we actually need to add 3 no-ops. So adding 2 assumes I'm reading while I'm writing. Yes? Do no-ops stand for no operation? Exactly, yes. An instruction that does nothing. And what does ISA stand for? Instruction set architecture. So that's a name for the the assembly plus machine code together that the processor supports, basically. I had assumed that was a CSO1 term, but maybe I need to check what's in CSO1. So I'm adding two knobs here. In doing that, I'm assuming we can read while we're writing. That assumes a register file that works rather differently than the one you dealt with in CSO1. So maybe it's more realistic to say you do it otherwise. In the assignment for the pipeline homework, if you look at it, we don't care what you do, which you assume, but potentially we could have three knobs added. So even more fun to reason about. So this is a possible solution, but not really a practical one. We don't like giving compilers and assembly writers the work of figuring out you need to have this many no-ops and having this change when we change the processor. But it's going to suggest to us kind of a hardware solution that's going to be a one way to resolve this problem. So if we don't want the compiler or assembly author to add these no operations, we can still add them, we just need the hardware to do it. So our idea here is going to be that we'll write the same assembly code, but the hardware will figure out, oh, for this to work, we need to have two no operations inserted in the middle. So I'm going to figure that out and just insert them instead of writing the next instruction right away. And so this is our simplest solution for pretty much all types of hazards, is that we have the hardware detect the hazard and insert these no operation instructions in place of fetching something until we've waited long enough that things are updated and we don't have a hazard anymore. And this idea is called stalling. And implementing in hardware, what are we doing? We're basically adding some extra logic to say, oh, if I see this conflict happen, stop incrementing the PC, keep it where it is, and just send bogus values in the pipeline register so we don't do anything. Question? So question, how often does this happen? So probably not very often, it turns out, but that's going to be for two reasons. So one is that we're going to have some better ways to resolve some of these hazards. So we will only resort to this way, which always works, but is pretty inefficient in sort of the worst cases. The other is that if you are a compiler author and you know processors work this way, you can write your assembly code so this doesn't happen very often, or doesn't happen at all even. Other questions? Yeah. So as I mentioned, this is going to be a solution that works. It's not going to be our preferred solution, but it's going to be always work. Our preferred solutions are going to mostly work. Yeah.
So I sort of started asking this a bit earlier, but I guess I wasn't super clear about it. Instead of stalling, could we run future operations that don't depend on the operations that we made?
So the question is, instead of inserting no operations, could we insert some future instructions? Absolutely. So the compiler, of course, can do this when it generates the assembly code. It could move instructions back. And processors could do this, and we'll talk about that as our topic after pipelining. We'll talk about out-of-order processors. The name out-of-order is precisely because they are doing that. They are inserting other instructions when they can't run the next one. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned this is a solution to this data hazard problem that We deal with the value not being updated yet by waiting until it's updated. We can do better than that. And the way we can do better is we can observe here that if I think about what's happening in this setup, I have a value I just read. So this is the value read for the OX2 instruction, and the value computed for the 0 instruction. They're available at the same time because we compute after we read. So while we're computing for instruction 0, the instruction at address 0, instruction at address 2 is reading the registers. And so we've just gotten the value from the register at the same time as we computed the new value. So we in fact have already computed what the new value should be. It's just in the wrong place. It's in the stuff for the first instruction and the second instructions using this old version. But the first instruction's value is there. We just don't have it in the right place in our processor yet. So pointing this out on this diagram here, so we have our sort of processor design. We've just done some math for our first instruction, and we've gotten our computed value out of this math logic. And the instruction that's reading the wrong version, if we don't do any stalling, if we just leave things as they were when they were broken, it's reading the old value out of the register at the same time. And we can fix this by just adding a wire to connect that computed value to replace the old value we're reading. So we just add a connection. Of course, we don't want to do this all the time. So we're going to add this connection with a multiplexer. And we're only going to choose the path of the multiplexer that comes from the math circuit in the case where the instruction actually uses the just computed value. Otherwise, we're going to use the one from the register file. So questions about this trick of taking the value we computed and substituting it for what we just read from the registers? The register file. Yes?
If it's happening in the same step, how do we know it's only reading after it's being computed? Like, how do we know it's not reading first and then computing in the same step?
Question, if it's happening in the same step, how do we know it's reading and not computing? So we don't know the relative timing of this register read and this math here. But what we do know is that this register here is going to store whatever value's there at the end of the clock cycle. So all we need to do is ensure that what it sees at the end of the clock cycle is correct. So remember, we're taking advantage here of the fact that we have these registers that use the clock cycle to know when to store new values. We're going to make sure whenever that clock cycle sort of edge happens, that they're going to see the value we want them to see, and we're going to use the mux and select the right one. And as long as that's computed within the clock cycle, we're fine. Yeah?
How do we know whether to use the computed value or not? Like, how do we know that the registers are overlapping?
So the question is, how do we write the logic that controls this mux here? And what we're going to do is we're going to have something that does compares the register number from the, the instruction in the execute stage and the register number from the one in the decode stage, basically. And so that's going to be our logic. It's going to turn out we're going to have a lot of options for forwarding, so there's lots of comparisons. This logic gets pretty complicated, but it's just a bunch of comparisons. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this idea is called forwarding. And this is going to be a reason why we don't need to stall all the time in these pipeline processors, that it's going to turn out most of the time we can resolve our data hazards through forward. There are going to be some exceptions. We will talk about the ones that happen with this five-stage pipeline very explicitly later. But most of the time, this is going to resolve our problem, so we're not going to pay that cost of inserting these do-nothing instructions. We're just going to find the value already. So I showed this case where we're forwarding in the case where we just computed a value that should replace the one we just read. There's some other cases where we can also use this forwarding pattern, which are going to make this mux here a lot more complicated. So another is, let's say instead of having the add followed by the add that uses the result of that first add, let's say they were spaced apart. So in that case, we still want to do forwarding, but the value we want to forward from is further on in the pipeline. So rather than being just computed, it's being passed through our memory stage that, in this example, does nothing because the add instruction doesn't use memory, but it's somewhere else in the processor. We still want to grab that value and have it replace what was just read. So we're going to do that. We're going to have this other path that we're going to add another input to that mux, which means that, yeah, the control logic for this mux, it is just comparing register numbers, but it's going to be pretty complicated. But the key idea is that we just look for all the places the value could be, and we're going to have inputs to the mux for each of them. And we just need to make sure we select them at the appropriate times. Okay, so questions? Our forwarding concept. So let's do a little example. And let's say for this example, yeah, we're asking, are the values not forwarded, or could they be forwarded to the code? So we're going to assume we're always sort of replacing the value we just read. We'll learn that that isn't, we could put the value elsewhere. Let's assume we're always replacing the value that's just read. So therefore, to the decode stage, the D stage, from somewhere else, potentially, or they're not forwarded, meaning we just read it from the register file as if the other instructions didn't exist, and that's how it's going to work. Have this sequence of four instructions, figure out what goes in there, check with your neighbors, give you a minute or so. I guess I should give the reminder of AT&T syntax assembly. This is R8 plus R9 into R9 for the first instruction.
Thank you.
Who'd like some more time? Okay, you can help. Okay, so who thanks for our first question is, when we're writing the sub queue in our decode stage here, where do we get the value of our 8? So who thinks A, it's not forwarded from anywhere, we just get it from the register file. Thanks B, it's forwarded from to the code from execute, which would be from this add queue here. Okay, and one of the other answers? So I think A is probably our best answer with the information we have here. So maybe it's possible, we actually get enough information. Maybe there's some instruction beforehand, which computed the value of R8. But at the add here, it uses R8, but it's not going to be our source of the value of R8 because it didn't change it. And we don't actually know the value of R8 is still being kept anymore. It did the add and probably doesn't keep the old values. So we're just going to get it from our register file. And how about here? In the XOR, where do we get the value of R9? So who thinks A, it's not forwarded, we just get it from the register file. Thinks B, it's forwarded to the code from execute. Okay. C, to the code from memory. And D, to the code from write back. Okay, so I have to the code from memory. And so the way I drew this sort of red line to represent what's going on. And note that my line stays in a cycle because we're doing this forwarding within a clock cycle. And I'm taking the value that we have at the end of the memory stage here that's about to be going to some registers to be sent to the write back stage. And I'm going to send that to replace the value I just read in the decode stage as what I put in the register. So that represents this path here that we talked about before. Yes?
So for the XOR queue, I thought it would be forwarded from the execute stage because I read in the pipeline write-up that when you do computations, the decode can be triggered simultaneously with the execute. So what's the difference between computation and floating from it?
So the question is, do you think it would be forwarded from execute to decode? So you thought we would do... I'll draw. You thought we would do this path from E to D in cycle 3?
No, I just thought, for example, in the situation where add queue is, I thought it would forward from the execute stage on the add queue to the.
Okay, so you wanted to do this forwarding.
Yeah, yeah.
So the problem with that is that involves some time travel. And when we do forwarding, we always have to do it in within one cycle. In order to do this thing, we have to store a value across clock cycles somewhere, and we don't have a place to do that besides our pipeline registers. So maybe you can think of that happening, but the way it's happening is by taking this path.
Okay, so if you have to use R9 again, would that mean that you can only use R9 on the time when it's being modified previously?
Question, does that mean I can only use R9 on the time when it's being modified previously? No. So we know that after we compute the new R9 in the execute stage, that it has to stay around somewhere in the processor until it's actually written back. So we're guaranteed that it's available from that memory stage, even though it's not being computed on there.
Okay, so.
And that's why we can forward from memory, even though you're right, the add instruction doesn't do anything with the memory stage, the value wasn't computed there, but it has to be passed through that stage in order to get to the write back, and we know it makes it to the write back, because if it doesn't, we would never change our mind after the instruction finishes running.
So instructions always get forwarded from memory if you're using another register?
Question, do instructions always get forwarded from memory if we're using another register? I would say instructions always get forwarded. We take the value the instruction's going to write from whatever stage it's in. So in this example, we wanted the value during cycle 3, and we wanted it from the add queue. The add queue was in the memory stage. We have to take it from memory. From the memory stage. If the add queue was in the write back stage or the execute stage, we take it from E or W.
Okay.
But we can't take it from the past of the instruction, we have to take it where the instruction is right now in the processor. Question, if the XOR queue is way after the add queue, so yeah. So for example, if it was here, yeah, we wouldn't have to forward it.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because the value would be written.
Okay, so like after the write stage.
After the write, you don't have to forward, and that's good because we don't have anything to forward from.
Okay,
so let's do our AND queue. So AND queue, the R9 and AND queue. And the add queue, we're asking about the relationship there. Is it not forwarded from the add queue? Thinks A. Okay, how that, but it's forwarded to the code from the execute of add queue. How about to the code from the memory of add queue? To the code from the write back of add queue. Okay, so we have a split between A and I probably read this. Between A and between A and D. Or I should write this differently, right? Between D is that option and also A. So D would mean that we do this forwarding path here. And that is a new thing we can do. We can take the value that we're about to send to the register file, send it to replace the value we just read, if the register file wouldn't have it up to date for us. But there's a problem here, and that's if we look at this assembly, this XOR instruction, this is supposed to modify R9. And the way we usually assume assembly works is the instruction that last modified R9 is the one we should get the value of R9 from. And that's not the add instruction, that is the XOR instruction. So we actually want to forward from the XOR, which would be B in this next option here, and therefore we don't want to take the value from the add because that value is out of date. So we take the value from the add, we're going to compute the wrong number, we're getting this old value. So the problem here is we have two versions of R9. We wanted to use the most recent version, which came from the last instruction, not the earlier instruction. So questions about the reasoning for our last two, where we how we choose between two things we can both forward. Okay, so far it seemed like, gosh, I had all these sort of things that previously we figured out would actually compute the wrong answer, which would be bad and mean we basically couldn't do pipelining, and we fixed them, right? And that's great, but there's some cases where, you know, there's some reason I actually talked about stalling here, and that's because this isn't always going to be possible. And with the 5-stage pipeline, these, you know, fetch, decode, execute, memory write back, these sort of conventional common pipeline stages that we talked about, there's sort of one case we notably can't do. And that's reading a value from memory and then immediately using it for a computation. So if we think of that, here I have a move from memory using RAX as the memory address into RBX, and then I use RBX and a subtract. And you want to get the value of RBX. So to do that, here I've kind of notated where the forwarding kind of would naturally happen. That you might say, okay, we want to replace the value we just read. So you'd say, okay, so we do the forwarding to the code, but we can't forward from execute to the code because the value isn't read from memory yet. We don't do that to the memory stage. So forwarding to the code doesn't work. You know, so this doesn't work because it's sort of haven't read from memory yet. So we have our second option here, and this doesn't work because, you know, the value is sent too late. So here I'm replacing the value at the end of the execute stage. The subtract already did the subtraction, it's too late. We needed the value earlier. So if neither of these work, we're going to fix the problem by adding stalling combined with forwarding. So we're still going to do forwarding, but we can't forward in the natural place, so we're going to stall until we can. And in this case, by delaying for one cycle, I can make it so we can forward from memory to the code. That's going to be forwarded after the value is computed because it's from memory when we've actually read it from memory, and before it's needed, which is going to be decode, which is before the execute stage when we actually do the subtraction, so this will actually work. And you notice here when I'm notating the stall, I'm indicating that the decode stage is repeated. The reason I'm doing that instead of repeating the fetch stage or delaying the fetch stage, my assumption is how this would work in the processor is that we fetch the subtract instruction, we go to read the registers, and then some circuitry would detect, wait a moment, this register read isn't going to work, and would keep the subtract instruction in the decode stage, and it would delay the instruction that's going next, so it would repeat its fetch stage rather than letting it advance to decode while we're waiting for the subtract instruction to be ready to go. So here we're still using forwarding, but we use it combined with stalling to resolve this data hazard. So questions? Yeah.
What would this actually look like? Like, would we make it come back into itself circuit-wise?
Would we make it come back into itself circuit-wise? That would be a way you could implement it, yes. So you'd have, if we think here, right, we'd have some logic that, like, allows this to loop back and there would be a box to select the loop back value. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
I guess the bullet structures that use RCX afterwards have to be stalled again by the stall
result. Question, would instructions that use RCX, the result of the subtract, have to be stalled again? And the answer is no, because of what's going to happen to the following instruction. So we have some instruction here that uses RCX. it's going to need to go after the subtract. So it's going to be delayed because we can't have two instructions in the code, right? We can't. Only one instruction fits in the code at once. So just by leaving the subtract in the D stage, we're going to leave the next instruction in the F stage for an extra cycle. But after that, it just gets to go normally, and we can forward a value to it as usual, because the subtract, of course, computes the value in time for us to use it in execute. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, would every other instruction sort of have this repeated fetch stage? No, because we can't have two instructions in fetch. So the next instruction is going to be fetching while we're decoding, right? Because remember, we start with the first stage of the next instruction while the next stage goes on to its second stage. The previous instruction goes to its second stage. So assuming we have no other stalling, everything else would look quote unquote normal, like the diagrams we've seen before. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So this kind of makes it look like if we ever read a value and then from memory and then use it immediately, we have to stall in this sort of five-stage design. Turns out that isn't quite true. There's one case we can deal with, and this is something that processors that use this five-stage design actually do. And that's that if we read a value and then store it, well, we don't actually need the value. This is sort of where we use RBX here. So we don't need the value until later, so we can actually forward it, not replacing the thing we just read, but just in time for it to be used to store the memory. And processors do this because even though we could stall instead, it's sure a lot faster to do this, and even though it's extra logic that's going to take time, it's way worth not stalling more. And also, people write assembly code like this when they like write memcompy, so you kind of want to run it fast. Now, a complaint that I'm surprised I didn't get about this forwarding here, is some people would say, here, I told you, oh, this doesn't work because we get the value too late. And some of you might have complained, well, we need it in the execute stage, right? Couldn't we just forward it to the execute stage? And that is technically possible, but that's not an option we're going to consider. And I'm going to show you why here. That what you'd be proposing by doing that is we take the value we just read from memory, and we sort of send it to the math circuit. We can absolutely add that wire, add a mux to make it work. But there's a problem. And the problem is that this is going to be very bad for our cycle time. In particular, we're going to have, our clock cycle needs to do a memory load and a math at the same time. And if we did this, why did we bother splitting these up into separate stages? Right? Because our cycle time is as if we didn't do it. So this is not something we're going to do when we do forwarding. We're not going to make our cycle time much longer by forwarding something from like the end of a stage to the beginning. That's going to defeat the purpose of adding pipeline. And I guess I'm out of time. So our remaining topic on hazards is going to be about control hazards. So if we have like a conditional jump, if you think about that, we have a problem here that in the normal pipeline, we can't know what to fetch next. And if you looked at the homework, you've seen that our solution for this is going to be that we're going to guess. And if our guess is wrong, we're going to undo it. We'll talk about how that works next time.